From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. Marlon Brando died yesterday at aged 80. He was an icon on and off the screen, hulking, wounded, defiant. He played in some of America's greatest films. On the Waterfront, The Godfather, A Streetcar Named Desire, Apocalypse Now, and delivered some of film's most memorable lines.
I could have had class. I could have been a contender. I could have been somebody.
Hey, Stella! Hey, Stella!
In a month from now, this Hollywood big shot's gonna give you what you want.
Too late. They start shooting in a week.
I'm gonna make him an offer he can't refuse.
Brando won two Oscars for Best Leading Actor and was nominated for six others. He brought method acting, where an actor lives the part, to the silver screen. He infuriated directors, insulted gossip columnists, and became an activist for civil and Native American rights. In his later years, tabloid readers could follow the details of his unraveling private life. His three marriages ended in divorce. He became morbidly obese, and his career ended with a handful of roles in failed films. Tonight on Point, Marlon Brando, the life and films of one of the greatest actors of his generation. What was Marlon Brando's influence on American film? Where do you place him in the pantheon of great actors? What do you remember from Marlon Brando's career? Join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining us now from Brooklyn, New York, is Charlie Taylor. He's film critic and senior writer at Salon.com and has written extensively about Marlon Brando. Good evening and welcome, Charles Taylor.
Good evening.
Also with us from Stoddart, New Hampshire, is On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. He's senior editor at the Atlantic Monthly magazine. Good evening and welcome, Jack.
Good evening, Julian, and to our guest.
Charles Taylor, your thoughts on the passing of Marlon Brando?
Well, I think we've lost the greatest American actor. And I think for some of us, the greatest American actor we'll ever see. A man who... You know, as your intro said, did bring method acting into the consciousness of American moviegoers, and a process that I don't think is still as fully understood as it might be, and had a career that, you know, is still often talked about in terms of the highlights, but is, I think, even a richer career than is commonly acknowledged.
Jack Beattie?
Yes, you know, he came at a moment, put it this way, north of the Hayes office and south of the Blockbuster. That is, north of the, just in the point where the old censorship of the Hayes office was fading, and just before the Blockbuster arrived, which essentially forced a lot of acting off the screen, and there was this window there in the 50s and early 60s where great roles could be had and great actors could fill them, and he filled that role and especially took advantage of the Hayes opening. Without being explicitly sexual, everything he did conveyed sexual energy, and you know, we had romantic leads, leading men. He was something else. He was much more animal, much more raw, but also real. I mean, people could see, you know, in his conflicts and in his emotionality that he was really portraying something closer to a human being than what you usually see on the screen, where the actor gets sort of ossified, petrified in the role of the star. He just kept playing parts.
Charles Taylor, Marlon Brando from a very turbulent background. How did he come to acting?
Well, the stories are that New York in the 40s, Streetcar Named Desire, classes with Stella Adler. Pick up on something that Jack is talking about, which is his first film appearance in The Men, the Fred Zinnemann film from 1950, when you really see that difference. He's playing a paraplegic World War II veteran, and his wife in the film is played by Teresa Wright, who's a fine actress. I mean, Best Years of Our Lives and Shadow of a Doubt, a really, really solid actress. But next to Brando, she looks stodgy. And part of what's going on with that character in the film is that he has been humiliated on his wedding night because he can't make love to his wife. And there's a scene in the film where he's in a bar, and there's a fellow there who is giving him the speech about what a wonderful thing you've done making this sacrifice for your country. And Brando looks at him and says, "God bless you, mister. Can I marry your daughter?" And it's an incredibly impertinent moment. And, of course, it's a sexual moment.
Okay.
Because he's lacerating, you know, his own inability to perform sexually, and also bringing this man's daughter's sexual appetite into the conversation.
Well, let's just listen to another aspect of Marlon Brando's persona, a scene from the 1954 film On the Waterfront. Here's Marlon Brando as ex-fighter Terry Malloy stands up to corrupt Waterfront Union boss John Friendly, who he had previously testified against in court.
You take them heaters away from you and you're nothing, you know that?
You talk yourself in the river.
You take the good goods away and the kickbacks and a shakedown cabbage and a pistol arrows and you're nothing. Your guts is all in your wallet and your trigger finger, you know that?
You ratted on us, Terry.
From where you stand, maybe, but I'm standing over here now. I was ratting on myself all them years. I didn't even know it.
Come on.
You give it to Joey, you give it to Dugan, you give it to Charlie. It was one of your own. You think you're God Almighty, but you know what you are?
Come on.
You're a cheap, lousy, dirty, stinking mug.
We're joining us now from Martha's Vineyard, Massachusetts, is award-winning screenwriter Bud Schulberg. He wrote the screenplay for the film On the Waterfront, for which he won an Oscar. Marlon Brando also won an Oscar for his role in the film. Welcome, Bud Schulberg.
Hello. Hi.
What was Marlon Brando like to work with?
Pardon me?
What was Marlon Brando like to work with?
Well, he really was, at that time, except for one incident, he was totally cooperative. He really worked awfully well. He was right there on his marks. He was there every morning on time. He was a terribly demanding physical show to do outdoors in Hoboken, freezing weather. He took all of that in stride. He was really fine to work with, except, as I said, that we had one little run-in, and that was it.
At one point, I understand, Frank Sinatra was cast as Terry Malloy, but Marlon Brando got the job. What happened?
Well, what happened was Kazan, director Aaliyah, asked me to send the script to Marlon. We both thought he said when he read it, this would be ideal for Marlon. Sent it to him. About a week, he sent it back. We got it back. He had turned it down. And he didn't say why, no reason, nothing. Just, no, I won't do it. And at that point, we turned to Frankie Sinatra. Frank came from Hoboken, where we planned to shoot it. And Kazan said, well, he's a tough kid from Hoboken, and I can do it with them. And but at the same time, our producer, Sam Spiegel, never gave up on the dream of the hope of trying to inveigle Brando into coming back into it. And finally talked him back, seduced him back into doing it, and we had a, poor Frank had a fit, rightly so. And then we were off and running with Marlon.
You've spoken about Marlon Brando's good behavior at that time on the set. What was he like off the set?
Well, he worked awfully well, very down to earth. I suggested to Kazan, for instance, that we bring in a boxer to work with Marlon and show him the way that professional throws punches, how he walks, body language of a boxer. Roger Donahue, the young fighter that we brought him up to Stillman's gym and worked out with him. Mullen was very, very willing to do that. And in a few days, Roger came back to me and said, this kid learns so fast. He's such a quick study. He said, I really think I can make a hell of a middleweight out of him. He was serious about it. He thought he could make a great fighter out of Marlon, but it showed how Marlon threw himself into everything he was doing at that time.
Bud Schulberg, many thanks for being with us this hour. That was Bud Schulberg. He wrote the screenplay for the film On the Waterfront, for which he won an Oscar. And Charlie Taylor, arguably Marlon Brando went on fighting, if you like, throughout his life.
Yeah, he did. It could have been very easy for him to take to go into a sort of typical Hollywood career, and you get the sense more than anything else that the prospect of that bored him, and he wanted to keep doing different things, you know. And there is, from about 1961 to about 1969, around there, there are ups and downs in the film career, but this is often used against Brando, and I think one of the things that's not often talked about is this was when the studio system was really in its death throes, and I can't think of any other actor of his generation who didn't have a similarly checkered, you know, history in films in those years. And what's amazing about them is that there is often very astonishing work. I mean, one of his most astonishing performances is in John Huston's 1967 film Reflections in a Golden Eye, a movie that didn't do well, but Brando is quite amazing in it, and quite daring.
Across from Elizabeth Taylor.
Yep. Jack Peter, do you have a favorite Marlon Brando performance?
Well, of course, Terry Malloy, but my favorite Brando movie is the one movie he directed, One-Eyed Jacks, with Carl Malden, a Western. And he's sort of at his sexiest in there. Indeed, he plays up to, he seduces Carl Malden's daughter to punish Malden and then sort of leaves her high and dry. So I've taken your virtue. And, I mean, he's a real cad, but he turns around at the end. It's this powerful movie about betrayal, but it's got a lot of just raw stuff in it. And somehow he found in his camera work a touch of the poetry that was in him. It has some of, I don't know, I just think it has some of Brando's inner poetry in the look of it, you know.
And Charlie Taylor, what do you think it was that was so distinctive about Marlon Brando as an actor?
Boy, that's just an absolute American original, a man who I think found glamour without gloss, if you can say that. I mean, here was someone who came along and had all the charisma that we associate with stars and yet didn't seem to be interested particularly in protecting himself the way stars do. It's really hard to talk about what made Brando distinctive without talking about the method. And, you know, method acting, as I said, is very often misunderstood. It's talked about in terms of, well, the actor becomes the character. Well, that's not it. That's not acting. That's schizophrenia. It's really a sort of dedication to psychological and physical realism. And the critic Steve Weinberg, in his 1991 book, Method Actors, wrote about how since the primary mode of American filmmaking and American playwriting is naturalism and realism, it's a natural territory for the method to come in. So there was this sort of heightened naturalism that Brando brought and the rawness that Mr. Beatty has spoken of.
Okay, Charlie Taylor, do stay with us, and you too, Jack Beatty. We're talking tonight about American film icon Marlon Brando, who died yesterday at the age of 80. What was Marlon Brando's influence on American film? Where do you place him in the pantheon of great actors? Will you remember Brando in his prime, or will you remember the self-destructive Brando? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking tonight about Marlon Brando, who died yesterday at the age of 80. What do you remember of Marlon Brando's career? What was his influence on American film? Will you remember Brando in his prime, or will you remember the self-destructive Brando? You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Let's listen now to a scene, from the 1974 film The Godfather. Here, Marlon Brando is Don Vito Corleone, wishes he could have saved his son Michael, played by Al Pacino, from the mob business.
I never wanted this for you. I work my whole life. I don't apologize to take care of my family. And I refused to be a fool. Dancing on the string, held by all those big shots. I don't apologize, that's my life, but I thought that... But when it was your time, that you would be the one to hold the strings. Senator Corleone. Governor Corleone, something.
I'm not a peasant of Anta.
This wasn't enough time, Michael. Wasn't enough time.
Well, we're talking to Charlie Taylor, film critic and senior writer for Salon.com. He's written extensively about Marlon Brando. With us also, On Point news analyst Jack Beattie. Charlie Taylor, Marlon Brando's film career very much divided into two parts, The Godfather coming in the second part. And even for that film, I understand, he had to audition for the part.
Yeah, that's what I understand, too. And again, part of what I talked about earlier, I think that had probably less to do with Coppola than more to do with Charlie Bloodhorn, who was the head of production at Paramount at the time, and possibly Robert Evans, who was the producer of the film. But there was sort of a sense that the man was washed up, that he, you know, was a former star, hadn't done much work. Again, nonsense if you had actually been looking at what he had been doing. But, you know, the film is still talked about as if it were a comeback, and he is magnificent in it. And he followed it up with what I think is not just his greatest performance, but I you know, I'll go on record as saying I think the greatest performance I've ever seen any actor give in the lead in Last Tango in Paris.
That a film not as widely known as, for instance, The Godfather or Apocalypse Now. Jack Beattie, we heard a sense there from Charlie Taylor of the beginning of the pushing of the self-destruct button in Marlon Brando's life.
Yes, and you know, that role, really, of the tragic patriarch, how that foreshadows his own life, doesn't it, huh? His children destroyed, one destroyed, or one committed suicide, one murdered someone. I mean, almost, there it was happening 20 years earlier for him. You know, it's hard to figure. I mean, in a way, it's a little bit like complaining, boy, why couldn't that Shakespeare guy do another good play? You know, there aren't many actors who've had these roles that he's had, who've been at the top of their game for so long. So in a way, it's churlish and ungracious to complain that he didn't keep coming out with the great roles. For one thing, increasingly, they weren't there.
Well, and for one thing, increasingly, and I'm sorry to interrupt, but they weren't given to him. I mean, you know, for all the talk about, oh, the last years and the self-destruction, the last years has one of his most charming performances in Andrew Bergman's film, The Freshman. And I said in the obit I wrote for Salon, I don't think there's any of his appearances in the last two decades, and most of them in very bad movies like The Score and A Dry White Season, there's not an appearance where you don't feel his joy in acting, and he doesn't bring some wit and liveliness to the screen. And often, you know, just as he was in the early years, I mean, we talk of Brando as a rebel, but mediocrity rules in Hollywood. And so by the end of it, he, you know, he's fighting these forces again. And apparently when he did the film The Score, he wanted to do something much more flamboyant than he had, but he was overruled by the director, Frank Oz. Now, Frank Oz, who's the guy who directed The Stepford Wives, is an occasionally amusing filmmaker, but he's, for all intents and purposes, a hack. And, you know, we are talking about a hack having veto over Marlon Brando. And that seems to me really the tragedy of not just Brando, but of anyone who's ever tried to be creative or original in American movies.
Okay, I'd like to bring into the conversation Richard Schickel, film critic from Time magazine and author of Brando, Life in Our Times. And he joins us from Los Angeles. Richard Schickel, welcome.
Thank you.
And your thoughts, firstly, on the passing of Marlon Brando?
Well, I mean, some of my thoughts are a little bit ruled by what I've been hearing in the last few minutes on your show. I mean, I don't think Brando's late years were all that wonderful. I mean, I agree. I think The Freshman is a charming and sort of strangely dainty performance by him. But and I didn't see an awful lot of joy in his work. I saw a lot of cynicism in his work and a lot of, okay, folks, I'm making my next couple of million here, and, you know, you can all wait around and watch me do that, and maybe I'll bring a little something to it, but probably I won't. I mean, you know, if you were part of Brando's crowd when you were young and he burst on the scene, I mean, to see that kind of acting when he had been not just a great actor as a young actor, in what he brought to the screen, which was a kind of, you know, remarkable behavioral truthfulness. But he was also kind of an exemplar for us. I mean, he was the inarticulate guy who was trying to articulate all the things all the rest of us are inarticulate guys were trying to inarticulate.
So not just an acting phenomenon, but a cultural phenomenon as well.
Well, he was both. He was an acting phenomenon who was a cultural phenomenon. And, you know, if you remember him in those great days, you know, to see what he was doing in recent years is at best a disappointment, you know. And, you know, I am not one of those people who think that, you know, Hollywood is the font of all evil in the world. I mean, it is possible to do good work in movies. It happens all the time. And, you know, and I don't particularly think Frank Oz is a hack. And I think he's probably a guy, you know, working with a very difficult case on that movie. But, you know, I think all of that should be, you know, in some ways on the day of his death to be somewhat set aside. I mean, I do believe he became vastly disappointed by what was offered him and what he could obtain in the movies. I think, you know, his great days as an actor were pretty well over by the mid-50s, with the exception of the great flaring up of The Godfather and Last Tango, which were both very different performances and very brilliant performances.
Okay.
But, you know, come on, guys, it's... he at least did a half dozen movies that will be watched as long as movies are watched by people. And, you know, not all that many actors get to do that many.
Okay, so. Richard Schickel, before we get the reaction of Charlie Taylor and Jack Beatty to that assessment, let's just hear from a couple of callers. Gabrielle, calling from Plymouth, Massachusetts. What did you want to say, Gabrielle?
The most remarkable role is his rendition, his interpretation of John Steinbeck's biography of Emiliano Zapata. I don't know if you remember Viva Zapata, but his performance was flawless, and he gave us on screen the wealth of a history of Mexico, the social customs, the human condition, the status of the revolution with Pancho Villa in the north, Zapata in the south, and Porfirio Diaz running away in France wealthy, and this whole history of Mexico, and the way he walked, and the way he looked, and he really made of it a true classic that I use in my classes.
Okay, Gabrielle, many thanks for that. Let's just hear from Michael, calling from Cambridge, Massachusetts. Michael?
Yeah, well, I want to say that long before Tom Cruise and Born on the 4th of July and John Voight and Coming Home, Marlon Brando really set the bar for depicting combat veterans who were injured and sustained spinal cord injuries in war, and the depiction of the adjustments and the discrimination and the different things that they had to undergo with family in adjusting to spinal cord injury. And it was just a remarkable performance in the men.
Okay. Charlie Taylor, Brando's enduring influence, then, in your opinion, on American film?
Well,
impossible to imagine. I think some of the actors that have followed in his wake without Brando, impossible to imagine Pacino or De Niro or Ed Harris, Nick Nolte. He was lucky enough to come along at a time when there were both writers and directors who wanted what he had to offer, and that confluence really shaped an influence that I think we, you know, still see today, down to actors like Sean Penn and at his best, Nicolas Cage, who, you know, are his heirs.
Jack Beatty?
Yes, I mean, he brought something adult to the movies. You know, you go back and look at the 40s, and I think of people like George Brent, and, you know, they were entertaining and so on, but it wasn't grown up in some fundamental way. It was like reading a Henry James novel, you know. This was all out there, but it didn't seem fully grown up. But with Brando, you got the whole man, I mean, from the unconscious up, from the inside out, and that did change screen acting. It could become a medium for the delivery of truth, not just entertainment.
Richard Chickle.
I think it's true. I mean, you know, I think there's before Brando and after Brando in screen acting. I mean, there are wonderful actors in the movies prior to Brando, whether it was Cary Grant or Jimmy Cagney or whoever. But what he did was change, among other things, our expectations of what acting, good acting, was. And, you know, he was the bellwether of a whole school of actors coming out of New York and the group theater and actors studio and such like. And he brought that. He was what they needed and what they'd wanted for a couple of decades. And he was so gorgeous and so exciting and so sexy that he carried, in a way, all before him. And so, you know, That's why, for example, we made him one of the 100 most influential people in America in Time magazine, you know, just because of the enormous influence that he had. I mean, and it's not just the great good actors of latter days. I mean, you see that kind of work in off-Broadway, in B-pictures. I mean, it's just the whole standard of acting changed after Brando. And that's a huge thing, and it's a sadness to me that he didn't sort of recognize that and take pleasure in it and all that, and instead of sort of in his later years sort of condemning acting as a childlike activity that wasn't really something a grown-up man should do. I mean, I, of course, think it is something grown-up men should do, and I think he did it brilliantly. And you know, those moments of truth that he gave you where he just broke through the fictional frame and made you kind of look not just at an actor but at some aspect of yourself on the screen were just, they were breathtaking.
Jack Beatty, I mean, Brando did, I think, obviously at some point seem to lose interest in acting and become more concerned with political causes. Do you think that alienated or endeared him to his audiences?
I just don't know. It certainly made him sort of persona non grata, I suspect, in Hollywood. And he got this reputation of being trouble and wanting to make statements in his film. But, you know, he also turned his politics in a very constructive direction. One of his great films, to me, in roles, is in a film called Burn by Guillo Portocorvo, the great Italian director, the man who did Battle of Algiers. And in this he plays a sort of a kind of ugly American, but a Britisher in the 19th century, putting down a slave rebellion in the Caribbean. And he plays this role wickedly, and it's as close to Trotsky's Permanent Revolution as any film you ever see. There's one revolution that beats up the other one, and it's a strikingly political film about oppression. And that's an example, I think, of his politics in a very positive direction.
Yeah, but isn't it funny, though, Jack, you know, that he came to not like that. He fell out with the director, and he, you know, got all disappointed and discouraged by that picture. It so often happened with him, I mean, on a personal level. I kind of agree with you. It's a very flawed movie, but it's a very interesting movie, and I just think, you know, he could never, I mean, that was part of Brando. He could never kind of quite, you know, separate himself and whatever was going on in his head from the role and whatever was going on in that person's head. So there were always these kind of interesting confusions of realms in his in his acting. Sometimes it worked great. Sometimes I think it worked less great. But, you know, they're wonderful. People kind of forget. There are a lot of movies he made that weren't successful, but Reflections in a Golden Eye is a wonderful, haunted, haunting kind of a performance. And I even like him in The Missouri Breaks, where he's just so playful and funny and out there. There's a lot of good work going on with this guy in things that people didn't appreciate. People didn't appreciate, and incidentally, the Byrne performance is kind of a variation on the same thing he did in Mutiny on the Bounty, where he's just excoriated for it. But he's fabulous in that.
Terrific.
Great performance, you know.
But Richard Chickle, I mean, how do you think he is now going to be remembered, particularly after the sadness and turmoil of his final years?
Oh, you know, we all lead foolish, stupid lives, don't we? And unfortunately for actors, they have to lead their foolish, stupid lives in public. I think that will all fade away because, you know, all that's left, finally, for actors is what's ever on celluloid, you know? And I think, you know, those things will last and people will forget all his misadventures in his private life, and I think those performances will last just because they are so striking. And it's funny, even though there are lots of actors who crawled out from under his overcoat, by golly, you know, if you go back and look at the authentic thing, the real deal, you know, it's the first, and the first is often the thing that, you know, just clings to memory forever. And I think, you know, but I'm speaking as a guy who, you know, just fell in love with this guy somewhere about 1950.
Okay, and
never totally abandoned. I used to get mad at him for doing dopey work. But
Richard Chickle, just a final word from Charlie Taylor on Marlon Brando's legacy, very briefly.
Well, as I said earlier, the greatest American actor, and I think, you know, as Richard said, what we are left with is the work, and the greatest of it is unassailable.
Jack Beatty, quick word from you, very, very quick.
Well, you know, in some ways, I'm wondering if this is a guy whose authenticity ultimately did him in. You know, he was playing with dangerous stuff as an actor, and you can almost see that dangerous stuff leaking out into his life.
Okay, on point, news analyst Jack Beatty, thanks very much for being with us. You too, Charlie Taylor, film critic and senior writer for Salon.com. He's written extensively about Marlon Brando. And also to you, Richard Chinkle, many thanks for being with us. Richard Chinkle, film critic for Time magazine, author of Brando, A Life in Our Times. You can continue the conversation online. Go to onepointradio.org and click on forums. After the break, we talk with the director of De Lovely, the new film about the life and music of songwriting legend Cole Porter. This is On Point. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
I feel a sudden urge to sing the kind of ditty that invokes the spring. So control your desire to curse. Well, I crucify the birds. This verse you've started seems to me the temp antithesis of melody. So to spare you all the pain, I'll skip the daunting and sing the refrain.
Well, Cole Porter's songs don't finish when the last bar is sung. They linger on your tongue, in your step. They make you want to misbehave, fall in love, and believe that anything goes. A new film about Cole Porter, starring Kevin Kline and Ashley Judd, called De Lovely, opens today nationwide and brings back more than 30 of Porter's delightful, delicious hits. Up next on Point, Cole Porter making music and misbehaving. Joining me now from Culver City, California, is Erwin Winkler, director and co-producer of the new Cole Porter film, De Lovely. He also produced Rocky, Raging Bull, The Right Stuff, Goodfellas, and dozens of other films. Erwin Winkler, many thanks for being with us.
My pleasure.
Why do a film on Cole Porter?
Well, I think he is really an American icon. The contribution he made to American music is unassailable as far as both music and lyrics. There hasn't been anybody other than Stephen Sondheim and perhaps Irving Berlin that was that prodigious in their output.
Just take us through some of the highlights of his life as portrayed in your film.
Well, what we try to do is present this musical in a different form. The film starts with this sickly old man, Cole Porter, facing death. And a mysterious, you might call him the Archangel Gabriel, played by Jonathan Pryce, visits him in his Waldorf Astoria apartment and transforms him back to an old dusty theater where his whole life is played out in front of he and Jonathan Pryce. And they comment about his life, and we present his life as a big theatrical production that's put on this stage. So the format is somewhat like the Great Ziegfeld and a little bit like All That Jazz, except the music is separates it from, obviously, anything else.
Well, having seen the film myself, I must say how much I enjoyed it. Just let's listen, though, to a scene from De Lovely. Here's Kevin Kline as Cole Porter fumbles as he tells Linda Thomas, played by Asley Judd, that they'll have a non-traditional marriage.
You know, I've never had the urge to be completely honest with anyone until you. It's quite disturbing, especially since I haven't been totally honest.
You knew so much about me when we met, Cole. Don't you think I'd heard a thing or two about you?
Then you know about, well, that I can be, that I have other interests. Interests the pursuit of which some people might find cruel to you.
You mean men?
Yes, men.
Owen Winkler, I mean, you're trying to be far more frank, aren't you, in this film about Cole Porter's sexuality than the 1946 Porter film Night and Day?
Yeah, Porter himself detested Night and Day because it was such a sanitized version of his life. And he was not, although he lived in a time when a gay man wouldn't come out very easily, he did not hide his sexuality at all. We thought, and we're sure of that, that the times are right, that people are more than willing to accept a frank look at a man's life. And what attracted me also in the story is the fact that it was a love story between a gay man and a woman that lasted for 38 years. He was madly in love with her. She was madly in love with him. It produced a great, great deal of music, great music, because of their relationship, because he wrote a great many of the songs for her. She was his muse. She introduced him to those people that really helped his career. Don't forget, Porter did not have a play on Broadway until he was 40 years old. Gershwin died at the age of 38.
And in the film, though, you portray the relationship between Cole Porter and his wife, Linda. To begin with, she was tolerant about his sexuality, but it started, didn't it? I mean, in the end, it rankled with her.
Well, when he was very, very active and not very discreet, because she was a woman of great dignity, she left him and didn't return until he had this terrible accident where a horse fell on him and broke both his legs. And for the rest of their relationship, he toned down his promiscuity. She accepted it. As a matter of fact, as we show in the film, she introduced him to a gentleman who spent the last few years of his life with him because she knew she was going to die.
What do you think it is?
She felt he should have a companion.
Yeah. I mean, what do you think it is about Cole Porter's songs that resonate so much? I mean, not just with American audiences, but far beyond these shores.
Well, lyrically, it's brilliant. Musically, it's brilliant. Those are two things to start with. They're very sophisticated, but also they're very personal. When you think about what is this thing called love, which is one of his songs, when you think about the great love song from Kiss Me, Kate, So in Love, it starts off with Strange Dear but True Dear. When you think of Anything Goes, Experiment, any number of films, they're all questioning about love. It's a question that a lot of us are looking for answers to, and he constantly poses that question. Besides that, he could also write, and did write, some of the most entertaining, sophisticated melodies and lyrics that we found in the American songbook.
I mean, I'm sure that an awful lot of people who go to see this film will hear tunes and realize, perhaps for the first time, that they've been written by Cole Porter. But you're trying also to reach out to a wider audience by having those songs sung by contemporary artists.
Yeah, I was very pleased when I started thinking about who we would get to sing some of these songs, that some of the contemporary artists today, like Sheryl Crow and Alanis Morissette and Elvis Costello and Natalie Cole and others, were really very familiar with the Cole Porter music and wanted to sing it. We had them basically sing it in the form that they were written and in the time that they were written, because we recreated those times. And what law says that Elvis Costello can't sing Let's Misbehave? And he does it very well.
Well, let's listen to Cole Porter's Anything Goes, sung by Carolina Connor in the new movie, De Lovely.
In olden days, a glimpse of stocking was looked on as something shocking. Now, heaven knows, anything goes. Good authors, too, who once knew better words, now only use four letter words, writing prose. Anything goes.
You say in your prayers
you lie. If green cares you lie. If old chairs you lie.
And Owen Winkler, so much there in the lyrics. An awful lot of ambiguity. I would have thought quite risque at the time.
Yes, very, very, very risque. Even for today's audience, I think. But what we try to do is use all the songs as part of the storytelling technique. I threw out the historical aspect of And Then He Wrote, and I didn't feel bound by the fact that if he wrote a song in 1950, I couldn't use it until a scene played out in 1950, because, for instance, Anything Goes is used in the song when he really wants to tell Linda, or we want to tell the audience what his activities sexually are going to be about. And we had this catalog of 1,200 songs to choose from, and the Cole Porter Trust was willing to put all those songs in our availability file.
Because a lot of critics have had a go at you, in fact, for transposing those songs in different ages, but you stand by it as a dramatic device.
Yeah, I mean, look, we're as smart as those critics. We know when those songs were written. It's pretty obvious, and I'd rather have an interesting story than worry about when he wrote something. Now, and by the way, and also the form that we tell the story is just that. I mean, he's as a man looking back at his life. Does he said, do you say, I can't think of that because I wrote that in 1922 rather than 1918? I can't think about that song now?
I mean, from the start, Porter's songs call for trained theatrical singers like Ethel Merman, who could put over his tongue-twisting lyrics and make challenging melodies appear effortless. Did your contemporary artist have a problem with them?
No, the only time that we had any kind of serious discussion about anything like that was I had decided that it was very, very important that Begin the Begin is sung in a minor key, which most people are familiar with that song as it was done by Artie Shore in a dance version, without any lyrics, as a matter of fact. And it, for me, it was very important because it counterpoints Ashley Judd, Linda Porter's miscarriage. So I wanted it done almost like a dirge. So when I talked to Sheryl Crow about that, she understood it and loved the idea. Some purists take umbrage at the changing of the tempo. The truth of the matter is every song is sung in a different way. You're not bound by any specific tempo in any way you sing a song. I've heard Cole Porter's songs from Night and Day to I've Got You Under My Skin sung 30 different ways.
And you have Kevin Kline in the film also singing and insisting on not using lip syncing.
Yeah, well, Kevin felt very strongly, because he had a bad experience in a previous film, that we could get better acting, and most of his songs are not sung in any other way. They're sung as part of the storytelling. And he felt we can be much more dramatic if he sang the song live on the set. And, of course, we got a lot of negative comments from our sound department, said, oh, you can't do that. Musicals aren't done that way. You have to pre-record it and all that. But we did it, and it was very, very successful, and makes the whole story much more intimate.
Do you feel you've now told the Cole Porter story?
No, I wish I could have another film to make to use another 30 songs, because I think we just scratched the surface of the music. I think we've told the complete story of the band's life and his relationship with Linda. I started the when I started editing, we started with the story starts basically with he and Linda meeting, and really comes to a dramatic end when Linda dies. So I thought it was very, very important that that be the focus of what we were doing, and that's the dramatic story I chose to tell. He lived 74 years. If we could probably pick another 5 years, and he had such an interesting life, and pull that out and say, okay, let's do that, yeah, 5 years of his life.
But of course, Cole Porter himself had a slightly ambiguous relationship, didn't he, with Hollywood?
Yes. Well, he was very, very taken with the sexual side of Hollywood. Less so with the kind of work he was asked to do. But he did love the fact that, for instance, Night and Day, which Fred Astaire did originally on stage, and then became a great dance number in his repertoire. He loved the fact that he had that success. But he loved the social life of Hollywood, or shall I say the sexual life of Hollywood at the time. He was less smitten by the attitudes of the folks that ran the studios in those days.
Owen Winkler.
And I think we show that a bit, yeah, when we do the Be a Clown number.
It's all there. Owen Winkler, many thanks for being with us. Owen Winkler, director and producer of the new Cole Porter film, De Lovely. And we'll finish this hour with Sheryl Crow singing Begin the Begin from the music, from the movie De Lovely. I'm Julian Marshall, sitting in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.